If you're a parent, teacher, or school leader, and you're sick and tired of the frustration, anger, and unfair treatment of children at high risk in our public schools, then perhaps it's time for all of us to do something about it. In this podcast, Dr. Amitra Berry brings you tips, tools, strategies, and tactics to build successful solutions while touching, moving, and inspiring all of us to transform our schools so that every child thrives. Here's your host, Dr. Berry.
Welcome back, Equity Warriors. Thanks for tuning in to another episode focused on the intersection of politics and education here on the 3E podcast. Let's talk about testing, high-stakes testing, state testing. In education circles, we tend to call it assessment because it sounds better. It's a less charged word. And by assessment, what we're talking about is the evaluation or the estimation of the nature or the quality or the ability of someone or something. So why do I want to talk about assessment today? Well, let me give you just a little bit of background. In my dissertation, I hypothesized about academic achievement in majority of color, low wealth districts across the United States, 64 of them. And one of the things I looked at were nationally normed and state assessments, those high stakes tests of reading achievement. And as I was going through this enormous process, I ran into a couple of hiccups because I was looking at data for a 10-year period. And what I found was that in many states, they kept renorming or redesigning the state assessment. And when that happens, or what seemed to be, the focus was in order to get a higher number of students scoring at proficient and advanced levels. Now, you can ask whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. At the time I was doing my study, I just thought it was a wrong thing. And many times today, I think it's a wrong thing, but we have to dig deeper into the why. Why are they renorming tests? Why are they redesigning tests? And there are some great reasons to redesign an assessment. If we find out that the assessments are flawed, that perhaps there is a social or ethnic or cultural bias in the testing, absolutely, it does need to be redesigned. If we are renorming because we did not norm the test on a population that is similar to the demographic under study, absolutely, we need to renorm the test. But if we are simply shifting things around so that it looks like our students are doing better, you know, I call bullshit on that one. So when we look at assessments, we have to look not just at state assessments, or as I say, just measuring the fish that are in your pond, we need to look at how our fish compare to fish across the country, and even more so in a global economy, at our students across the nation. How do our learners stack up against their peers from other countries? And in some cases, what I see is that we have tests that are focused on more of an isolationism. We only care about our kids looking good and being able to do the jobs in our own economy. We don't really care whether or not they can get into a college somewhere else in the country or somewhere else in the world, or that they can compete on a global level later on. So why am I on my bend about assessment? Well, in my journals that come across my desk, one of which is EdWeek, there was a special report in EdWeek about reading and literacy and the design flaws with the reading tests in the state of Louisiana. Now, Louisiana was one of the 32 states with districts that were included in my research. So it caught my attention right away. So there are some problems with high-stakes assessments, absolutely. Number one that we hear all the time and that I really think we need to think about is that high-stakes assessment is a single snapshot in time over the course of roughly 180 days in a school year. How well that child was performing on that day in that classroom, under those circumstances, did they have breakfast? Did they sleep well the night before? What other things are going on in their home? None of that counts. It's just that number on that day. And so I don't think that, and many people agree with me, that to put so much emphasis on how well students do on a high stakes assessment one day or even 1 week out of the course of a year, it's wrong. So one of the things that our high stakes assessments also do or don't consider is background knowledge, or how some children who come from families with lower levels of income compete with students who come from higher levels of income that have had exposure to contexts outside of school and outside of their home environment. And when I think about that, I often think about my own grandson, and I feel very fortunate that we were able, or are able, he's in high school, he's 16, that we have been able over his lifetime to expose him to things that he would never get in his regular K-12 education, and that unfortunately many, or probably most of his peers have not had access to or exposure to. We also have to think about who is writing the test. Most psychometricians that are developing these tests don't look like me. And they don't look like the Black and Brown and Asian and Indigenous students that are in our schools. They're overwhelmingly white and male. And so their lived experiences, their intrinsic biases do make their way into tests, those state assessments that our children are scored against. So who's writing the test? And then we have to think about, what about the differences in the curriculum that's used from sometimes one district to district, definitely from state to state, because the standards vary from state to state. But even within some districts, particularly within larger districts where they have site-based decision making and principals are allowed to choose, or committees are allowed to choose whatever curriculum they want. And for our children who come from families of lower income, who may change schools 1, 2, 3. I'm talking to some educators out there. You know, you have kids that come and go all the time, and they may change curriculum within a single school district every single time they move. So they're not getting consistency of information and instruction. When you consider all of that, and then layer onto that, that we see even more significant differences in equity of assessment, particularly around understanding or comprehension of literature because of lived experience, because of the ability or the access to information outside of school or even information within school. Let's just say the way that we assess our learners in this nation has some warts. So what did Louisiana do? Louisiana recently developed the guidebooks curriculum. It was a statewide development by teachers in Louisiana of ELA curriculum for students in grades K through 8. Now, the jury is still out on their approach, but what they are doing is, or what they've done is, recraft their state assessment to reflect only or primarily their state guidebooks curriculum, a curriculum that leans more heavily into the lived experience of children in Louisiana, into contexts that they're familiar with. To make something really simple, in Louisiana, you might think about the geography of Louisiana. It's not a state where they get a lot of snow, right? So if we're talking about skiing trips or surfing and, you know, other things that these children would not have outside exposure to or knowledge of from their own lived experiences, is very different from perhaps a child who lives in and grows up in California, where they can ski or surf. They've got snow, they've got ocean. So creating curriculum that is very specific to that state, in this case, is good for children because it allows them to bring their own knowledge from outside the classroom into the curriculum, into the classroom, and to connect with things that are there. But what else does that do? Again, if we think about our kids not living in that little tiny pond of the state that they're in forever and being able to compete on a global basis, that's not necessarily a good thing. My humble opinion, if you limit what I'm allowed to learn, if you restrict my learning to only those contexts that are around me every single day and don't expose me to the rest of the world and what else is out there, and then you test me on that, yeah, I'll do great on the test. But how well will I do if I need to leave that state to get a job when I get out of high school? What are we relegating our public school children to? Those with money have options. Those with money don't limit the learning of their children. Like I said, my grandson, we started sending him to technology camp when he was, I think, 8 years old, something that his peers couldn't do or weren't doing, didn't have access to. My own emotional joy at seeing him learn to code when he was young and engaging in that type of instruction and environment, living on a college campus during the summer, that was wonderful. But at the same time, there is this bit of anguish that not every other child of color is getting that same exposure, those same experiences. So what do we do? Let's talk strategy for a minute. First, my new book, which is coming out this fall, focused on equitable instructional practices for culturally and linguistically diverse learners. Still not sure exactly what the title is, but I'll let you know. That book is loaded with strategies on equitable instructional practices. So here's one. Let's make sure that we educate our learners, not teach our learners. We need to educate them in foundational skills that are universal. We need to make sure that our children master those skills. I have been on that bandwagon for 30 years. Every single child should be able to read, write, think, and calculate on grade, on time. These are skills that can be learned to a high level of mastery. And with those skills, those tool skills, they can do anything. At K-3, we have all this information. You're hearing more and more, and I'll get into it in another episode. These read by three initiatives where children, if they don't master or score well enough on the test at third grade, they get retained. Not necessarily a good idea. Retention does not solve the problem. We need to make sure that we educate our learners. Educate, not teach. Strategy number two is we need to provide and promote wide reading. There is tremendous importance to learners having breadth of knowledge along with depth of knowledge, but they need to have more literature that covers more context, more places, more times, more perspectives, more cultures, other worlds. We need to stop banning books and stop limiting experience, stop limiting opportunities for our learners to expand their knowledge beyond their backyard. And strategy number three, we need to, in this country, we need to embrace and promote universal multilingual education. Our children should speak, read, and write in more than just English. Did you know that in more than 20 European countries, studying not one, but two foreign languages is compulsory? In some countries, they start as early as age 3. Others start at age 6. But that means that every child speaks their home language, a second language, and very often a third language. It's mandatory. And it's not just in Europe. In some countries in Asia, children are taught as many as, are you ready for this number? 16 different languages and dialects, beginning again in primary grades. Multilingual instruction is the norm across Asian countries. And yet in this country, we want to only teach in and only promote in English. We are doing a disservice to our children. So how do we make things like that happen? You know what to do. Get involved. Stay involved. Vote. Vote in your local elections. It is still primary season, but you've also got school board, mayor, city council. And remember that school board elections are very frequently decided by as few as 300 voters, not 300 votes, but 300 people who actually check a box for a school board member. Attend those local school board meetings. Find out what's going on in your district. Advocate through social media. Follow me across my channels. Post, repost, share, like. Don't keep my message to yourself and continue to join me every week. Connect with me on social. Use those links down in the notes. Send me your questions, topics, requests to info@askdrberry.com, and I will answer your questions and bring you more experts to help address those topics. As always, don't worry about the things you cannot change. Change the things you can no longer accept. and I'll see you next time.
That's it for today's episode of the 3E Podcast. Head over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in a grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 value private VIP day with Dr. Berry herself. Be sure to head over to 3epodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Dr. Berry's gift. Then join us on the next episode.